So I'm going to see you all here on what is obviously a very cold day. I'll introduce Dr. Trevor Partridge to you. He'll be giving the talk today. But also Zena Swanson is here as well. So hopefully following the presentation we can also maybe talk a little bit about the work or your thoughts between the two. So yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. Plants can't tell us their story. We've all got stories to tell, all interesting stories, but we've got to go and try and find out what their stories are. And for today, I've taken on the persona of the daisy, the common daisy. So I'm going to speak as if I was the daisy today, telling you my story and how I finished up out there. So just to introduce myself, I'm the botanist at Christchurch City Council. I work just down the street down here on the third floor of City Environment at Chewham Street. I'm an ex-research scientist at DSIR in Botany Division and Land Care. I left there in 2003 and did consultancy for 3 years before I got this wonderful job at the City Council. Someone once described, they said to me that I had the perfect job and they, as a result of that, they didn't like me anymore. So I do have this wonderful job. So, unravelling the daisy chain, every plant tells a story. Let's head on. So, who am I? What am I? Okay, so the daisy, the common daisy that has been used in the spray next door. In Latin, my name is Bellus Perennis L, full stop. Okay, all of that's important. Common names around the world are known as the daisy, the double daisy, English daisy, common daisy, lawn daisy. And where do I come from? I originally come from Europe, probably, although I'm naturally distributed from Europe to West Asia. First recorded in New Zealand in 1867, although I've made my way around the world to all kinds of places. I turn up in lawns just about everywhere, so you could say that I'm a very successful immigrant. So let's take a look at me. Here I am in a lawn where I'm usually found with some of my mates. You'll see my mate ryegrass around the edge there. And if you look, you can see carefully some rather sort of darker leaves down the bottom on the left there. And that's my mate buttercup, creeping buttercup. Those people who have lawns often don't like me and my mate buttercup. They kind of go together. But I think I'm a little bit better than buttercup because as you can see, I'm in flower. I flower most of the time. So there I am, in my normal habitat in a lawn. So, remember my name, I had Bellus Perennis L full stop. The full stop's important as well. So what's the L full stop for? L is for Linnaeus, the inventor of the binomial system of naming plants. So every plant, when you actually give its name, has got two names. It's like its surname first and then its Christian name second. So Bellus is my genus, and there are other species of Bellus as well. Perennis tells you which species of Bellus I am, and the L full stop tells you that I was named by Linnaeus. And Linnaeus is the person who started naming plants this way, so I go right back to the start of the naming system, one of the first. 1753 was the time I was named, and there's a picture there of Carl Linnaeus, also known as Carl von Linne, because he thought that having a lovely German name with von Linne would give him some sort of credibility, not that he needed it. But he certainly used it. So he lived from 1707 to 1778. The binomial system that's used for all living things was developed from Linnaeus' system. So let's have a look at me. First of all, my wonderful flowers. Okay, now I asked how many flowers there were in the installation out there. I haven't actually got an answer, but that's actually not the number of flowers in the installation at all. Because what you see as what you think is a single flower isn't. Now, if you take a look at this illustration here, you'll see that there are these things which look like petals, and these things which look like some kind of structure within the flower. In actual fact, each one of those is a flower. Each one of these, each one of those is a flower. Okay, so it's a whole lot of flowers bunched together. So that when you actually come to calculate the number of flowers that are in this display, what you have to do is you have to count the number of inflorescences there are there, and then multiply them by about, I'd say there's probably about 80 flowers in each inflorescence. So the number of flowers is actually vast. So this is a characteristic of my family, the daisy family, is to have a whole lot of flowers in what they call a capitulum, or a flower head, or an inflorescence, all bunched together. looking like an ordinary flower. So let's have a look at a bit more at a close-up. You can see I've actually got two kinds of flowers. The first of these white ones around the edge, which are called gray florets, and then there's these yellow ones on the inside, which are called disc florets. And you can see on the ray florets here that there is a stigma coming out, and in this case the ray florets are female only. The disc florets in the middle, you will see that there are stamens around the outside, and there's also a stigma, so they're bisexual. So amongst the daisy family, there are some that have male-only ray florets, some that have all kinds of combinations of those kinds of things there. And in some of the daisies, they've actually given up on one or the other of these. You'll see sometimes daisy heads of other species of daisy, not the bellus, which there are no ray florets at all. They're all the one type in the middle. And sometimes the ray florets and the disc florets are the same colours, sometimes there are actual variations within them as well. But you can see how many flowers that are actually crowded into each of those inflorescences. And each one of those flowers will produce one seed. And of course, my big mate, the sunflower, is probably the best example of seeing what a giant daisy flower is like. You don't have to get down with a hand lens or a close-up camera to actually see what it's like. So each one of those seeds hasn't come from an individual ovule, it's come from a whole flower. So large numbers of flowers. So that's what I look like close up. So let's get back to where you'll find me. Where do I grow? I grow mostly in lawns in New Zealand, but you'll also find me sometimes in pasture. The reason I'm so good in those kinds of situations is because I've got underground stems. So that means that I can creep underground, and just put up my shoots with my leaves and my inflorescences, whole bunches of flowers that you see there. And when someone comes over and mows it, they may mow off my flowers, but I'm still there underneath, so I'll come away again. So that's just the same as a lot of the lawn grasses and the other weeds in lawns and the other parts of lawns, is I just keep on coming back because I've got all my storage organs underground. Other places you'll find me, not very common, but you'll find me in places like wasteland. I'll often persist, provided the plants don't get too big around me. You'll sometimes find me on forest margins. You won't find me in the forest, it's too shady in there. You'll sometimes see me in forest clearings, stream banks, seepages, sometimes in cultivated lands, dunes and tussock grassland. Not very high altitude, I'll like to stick to the sort of lowlands and the montane areas without going too high. But I have really done well in New Zealand. I've gotten around just about everywhere. Everywhere in the north to South Island, you'll find very few grassy areas in New Zealand where lawns are that are not. Probably the far north is where they get the much more vigorous grasses, one of the places I haven't done too well. So I'm throughout North and South Islands, I'm in the Chatham Islands, and I've even made it onto the sub-Antarctic islands, such as Auckland and Campbell. That's produced because I produce so many good seed, and I can persist in those kind of environments, like grassy areas. So, let's have a look at some of my relatives. My closest relatives, of course, are the other species in the bellus. And you'll be very hard-pressed to find any of these others because there's none in New Zealand. I'm the only one that's ever been introduced to New Zealand successfully, as far as we know, and there's certainly not any others been growing wild. You'll see a couple of the 15 there. There's an annual species that's found in Europe and one that's found in America called the Southern Daisy or Bellus sylvestris. You can see they're very similar to me as far as the flowers go. The leaves are relatively similar as well, but the subtle differences, but none of these species have ever become as successful as me. They're kind of restricted to the normal places they are and not that easy to find. The others are actually quite rare. They're scattered around the world and never very common. Now, let's just sort of head away from that. My other relatives, they're a bit distant, the ones that aren't in Bellus. There's a native plant that looks almost like me, and that's growing in this little patch of moss there. You can see it there, and if you were to see that first, you would just think that would be another lawn daisy. It's actually a species of Brachyscome, or Brachyscome radicata, and it's about 6 or 7 native species, plus some exotic ones, in this genus, and that's probably some of my closest relatives. We're all together in the same subfamily called Asteraceae. We're part of this bigger family, the daisy family, or Asteraceae, All Saints Harvest Composite. So there are other plants, and there's some native plants that look like that. And he's a forest dweller. He will be found in the forest. And there's also other species in open grassland that look quite like me as well. So, how do we get on with the humans? Those other big things that we have to live with. People have different opinions about me. Some think I'm good and some think I'm bad. The people that think I'm good think me like me because I've got attractive flowers and I flower all year, so they've always got a chance to see me. I've been used for astringent properties, but not very much these days. And there are some special cultivars for gardeners, and I'll show you some of those later. You'll get quite surprised as to what some of those actually look at. And of course, my most useful form is the daisy chain. Thank you for promoting that, Zena, because people have tended to forget about this, and it's something that children do, but adults don't these days, and you should only encourage people. But there are some people who do not like me. And the flora of New Zealand, Cereus valles perennis, is an extremely common lawn weed. And it's that weed word that I don't like. Have a look at that later on, just to see my side of the story. Now, here's some of my cultivars. These are some of the ones that you can get from nurseries and grow in your garden. They haven't become aggressive and they haven't spread out like me, but you can see some funny things like the different coloured flowers in the bottom centre one there, where all my ray florets have gone to this lovely kind of reddish colour, and all my disc florets are still yellow. And the one immediately above that, you can see the ray florets are kind of taken over. There's dozens and dozens of those. These are called the double forms. There's still some disc florets. And on the one to his right there, you'll see that all the disc florets are gone altogether, and we've just got the white ray florets. And in some, like the one on the bottom right, we've gone proliferous, so some of the flowers have actually developed stalks and producing a whole lot of extra flowers themselves. So, this is but a small example of some of the cultivated ones that you can get and plant in your garden, and they'll never become a problem. So, these are all being derived from me. So, let's have a look at what I am. This is my plea to the Lawn Brigade. Now, I'm just going to go into my human mode for a moment and tell you that I hate lawns. Okay? I own a quarter acre section and I have no lawns. And my greatest day was giving away my lawnmower. Okay, so I don't like this. Going back into days even now. So what is a weed? A weed is a plant that isn't wanted in a particular place. So people don't want me, they can call me a weed. They do want me, they won't call me a weed. But there are weeds that have special status. Do I have a special status then as far as being a weed? And the special status is a weed, which is just simply somebody's opinion, becoming what we call a pest plant. Okay? These are plants that actually impose themselves in being a nuisance on a larger scale, not just a nuisance to one or two people at a time. And pest plants, the declaration of pest plants are covered by local authorities, and in our case it's Environment Canterbury, who create regulations surrounding them. So, the ability of people to do things with pest plants or have pest plants or what people are required to do with pest plants are covered by those authorities. So there's a big difference between what's generally regarded as a weed and a pest plant. So with that in mind, let's have a look what I might actually be. So let's have a look at some real pest plants. These are plants that have actually been declared as being pests. Oh, no, it's quite clear. I thought that was me in the bottom right there. It's not. It's a thing called Mexican daisy. He's got the most wonderful Latin name of Erigerum carvinskianus. It's an American thing, which is there. But there's some of the other plants that you're required to do things with. If you get old man's beard in your property, you might get a visit from Environment Canterbury who tells you to remove it. See if you leave a notice. If you've got bone seed that you're outside the Port Hills, you will get served with a notice. Similarly, broom, if you've got broom on your property and you're within 10 metres of the neighbour's property and he hasn't got broom, you will be required to clear it from 20 metre boundary lines around it. an aluminium plant, which is probably the curse of my garden, which I stupidly brought in once, is a plant that sort of spreads by stolons that kind of jump around and cover large areas of ground much more quickly. It's also shade tolerant. That tolerant. You won't get served with a notice about that, but if you dig up some and give it to your neighbour, then you're essentially breaking the law. It's a plant that you can build out to propagate. So there's some pest plants.
They're the real pests.
Now, there are those that aren't actually pest plants that can be a nuisance. Oh, there I am. I'm one of this group too, because some people think that I am a bit of a nuisance, but I'm just a weed and not a pest. And some of these actually can be quite bad, as you can see. All those others around me have been far worse than me. Create a major nuisance. They're not actually declared as pest plants. Periwinkle, ivy, spread just by covering large areas of ground. And they climb. Bindweed and ivy will climb. Umbrella sedge's problem is it looks like a native plant. Everybody plants it and thinks it's native, but it's not. And of course, hawthorn is one of those plants that's quite attractive, but it gets spread by birds, so it keeps on appearing up in people's gardens. So the lawn brigade thinks I'm a weed. Most other people don't really think I'm a weed. So I suppose I fit into this kind of category, but I'm not a pest plant. Nobody in New Zealand has ever said you cannot grow this plant, you cannot spread it around, you have to get rid of it. So I'm just a bit of a nuisance to those people who feel that way. So what actually makes a weed a pest? What would it actually take for someone to come along and declare me to be a pest rather than just a local weed? First of all, to become a pest, I would have to threaten real values. So just being a lawn weed doesn't count, okay? It's not actually threatening my neighbours. It's not actually threatening the existence of other species. It's not actually threatening the existence of the humans either. And secondly, it then has to be declared a pest on one of three lists. There's the National Action List, which are the 11 worst. 11 worst. We've only got one in Christchurch, and nobody is allowed to touch them if they appear. There's a big hit squad that comes down from Wellington called Biosecurity New Zealand, and they come down and spray it. We've had two infestations of a thing called Phragmites. One is in the Botanic Gardens, which we've been gradually getting rid of, and the other turned up just a couple of years ago out of Bexley, and they've come down and sprayed that. We're not even allowed to touch it. The second one is the regional list, which is the Environment Canterbury list, which is mainly kind of rural pests, things like gorse and bone seed, etc., etc. And the final list is the nursery accord list, and that was like the aluminium plant, which are plants that it's not illegal to have, but it is illegal to propagate and spread. So if you dig it up and give it to your neighbour or a nursery sells it, then they are essentially breaking the law. Environment Canterbury can come around and serve you with a notice for doing that kind of thing. I don't know how often those kind of nursery accord notices are ever given, but it seems that it's a pretty rare event. So the national ones are actioned at a high level, the regional ones are actioned at a kind of local level, and the nursery accord list doesn't seem to be actioned at all. But I'm not on any of those lists, so it doesn't apply to me. Then there are the rules, as I said, in regard to the nursery accord list, restricting propagation, and because I'm not on anybody's list in regard to that, they don't apply to me. And the rules are regarding what landowners have to do in regard to weeds and pests. Sometimes they're things like boundary clearance, other times they're things like they have to get rid of them altogether. And as I said, I'm not on any list, so this doesn't apply to me. So it's not a problem as far as I'm concerned. So, what am I? Just in summary. I'm a widespread exotic species in New Zealand. So all those people who just love their native plants and hate all the exotics won't like them. But I have done very well. I'm a weed to the lawn lovers, but who want nothing but grass. They walk over their lawns looking down very carefully, and the moment they see me and my flowers, I'm gone. But actually, I'm much nicer than that. I'm a plant with a fascinating botanical story. You saw where I came from, saw who named me all those years ago, seen how well I've done, seen my special flowers, all those things. And last of all, I'm the perfect excuse for making a daisy chain. And the risk of it all falling apart This is my point of view. First of all, have you ever seen another plant chain together to make a chain like the daisy's done? Have you ever seen any other plant done this way? And the reason you can do this is because if you're careful, my flower stalks don't split. And that's the problem. If you try and do this with any other plant, you'll find that is when you make that cut to chain the daisies through, I will actually split. The other thing that's been done with the display out here is that they've been flattened before they've been cut, which makes it even easier and even stronger. That's a very sensible way of doing things. So I've really got the market to myself. The daisy chain market is mine, and I think I've done really well with that. So that makes me something really special. Secondly, there's plenty of them. So you've got plenty of plants to make daisy chains. If you take all the daisies out of your lawn, there will only be more daisies a few days later. So there's plenty of daisies around, and you can get them throughout most of the summer. So all throughout most of the summer, you can go out and make a daisy chain without any trouble at all. So with such wonderful attributes, how could anybody call me a weed? So I rest my case. Okay, so thank you very much.
I mean, I'm particularly interested in the notion that, you know, although I agree with you and I don't necessarily consider daisies a weed, in terms of the spread of the daisies, I'd love to hear a little bit more about how daisies managed to get as far as the Auckland Islands and those kinds of things. Because I always assumed that daisies kind of grew in clumps and that they would sort of maybe go underground and start a new clump. But do the seeds also...
Two strategies. Yeah.
Okay.
One strategy is this ability to hold ground. That is mown or grazed. The second thing is that very good seed production. So if you can imagine that each one of those inflorescences produces probably about 30 or 40 seeds from both the ray and the disc florets, and that those seeds are very easily germinated, and because the thing is productive over the entire year, it becomes very successful at actually getting around, so find its way to places. Now, if you can imagine that you're growing in a place where stock are grazing, especially if those stock are sheep, then you will get your seeds into the sheep's wool. And what was introduced to cattle in Auckland Islands, which happens? Sheep. So sheep fur has been a great way of distributing exotic species. We have a whole flora of Australian plants in New Zealand, grasses and other plants that have seeds that get stuck in. They're called burrs that get stuck in sheep's wool, and it's suspected that the majority of those were introduced in stock brought from Australia previous 2 centuries ago. Can't say last century now, can you? All that time ago. So that's how they've gotten around. But the biggest problem that the daisies have is that if you don't graze it, then the bigger plants will take over and displace it. So the one thing I don't have is height. So I've got to be in these places that are kept constantly mown and all grazed. As soon as something big gets in, I'm disappearing.
I have a question just concerning taxonomy.
Yep.
With the standardisation that Linnaeus brought in,
yep.
Do you think there's any potential knowledge, Aboriginal knowledge, that has been lost over the centuries that could have been beneficial to them?
The way in which things were published before Linnaeus' time essentially were in the herbs.
Mm-hmm.
And the herbalists, starting with Dioscorides, were very, very important places for depositing that kind of information. So a lot of information was held in there. The biggest problem that they had was naming and people knowing that what they had in one place was the same as what they had in another. Probably the classic example for this is the plant called Mahu in New Zealand, okay, which is Melocytus ramiflorus in New Zealand. If you go throughout the Pacific Islands, you'll find plants called Mahu that are completely unrelated. Mahu in many Pacific languages simply means the plant that's very common. So translating that information is becomes the problem. And that was what the herbalists had the difficulty with. And it was when Linnaeus decided that things actually had relationships to each other, similarities, and he built the naming system on those similarities with this hierarchical system. that it became possible to translate that. And the other thing that Linnaeus did with this naming system is he developed the concept of the herbarium, which was a repository for specimens, so that every name has what's known as a type specimen associated with it, placed in the herbarium. And that type specimen is actually the only thing that has got that name. Every time you see something else, you pick up a daisy from the field, you think, what you're actually saying when you say that that is Vallis perennis, is that you think that that's the same thing that's in the sheet in the herbarium at Uppsala. Okay, so that's the way it's translated. So that name is actually applied to that specimen and it stays with that specimen forever. If someone decides that two specimens are the same, the earliest name gets priority and the second name disappears. That's just somebody's opinion. So that was the big advantage in that naming system. And of course, the most spectacular thing about the naming system is that this hierarchical system gained its justification for its existence when Darwin wrote about the theory of evolution, because that was the backup to the system. So the system survived its potential biggest threat ever, and that's why it survived today. It's actually covered by a code now called the International Code of Botanical Nomenclature. It's a simple set of rules. I think there's something like 16 articles in that code. Arguments and controversies are resolved on a biennial basis when the code group meets every 2 years to sort out these problems. People can put applications for name changes or incorrect names. Sometimes find an earlier published name. The question is, does that have to change because of that early one, especially if there's no specimen associated with it? So they resolve all those kinds of issues.
Can I ask a question about the herbarium?
Yeah.
Is it a book or an archive?
No, it's a massive archive. The biggest one in New Zealand is actually held at Landcare Research at Lincoln. It's a whole lot series of rooms with gigantic cabinets. With everything sorted by name. So if you get permission to go in there, you go in and you open up the cabinets and see a big list on the door as to what's actually in the cabinet. Pull out the folders with them there and you can open up and you'll see multiple specimens of each thing there. So that's the way the taxonomists actually do the naming, etc. So the repressed specimens of those. The type specimens are held very specially because they're the really important ones. And they're held at Lincoln, special vault, fireproof and everything else proof as well. A lot of the type specimens of New Zealand plants were actually lost during the Second World War because they were not held in New Zealand, because the early New Zealand botanists didn't name the plants and put them into the herbarium here, because there were none. They sent them back to Britain and Europe. So they finished up in places like Kew and Paris and in Berlin and places like that. A lot of those specimens. Some of them are actually still lost in the buildings. Every so often, some of the taxonomists go and try and find the lost specimens because they've just simply been misplaced. Every so often, something reappears that everybody thought was long gone as far as the specimens go. So we've got that one at Lincoln. There is also a Christchurch Botanic Gardens herbarium, but all the specimens the earliest specimens there are now stored with the ones at Lincoln as well. That one has essentially been it's not used these days for putting in many specimens, but we hope with the new gardens plan to actually have what we call a living herbarium. And this will be a place where people can actually go and see how this whole process is done.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have specimens on display. It shows people how to press them, how to put them on sheets, and how they make this. So hopefully we'll get that with the new gardens plan.
My next question was really about, what came first? Was it the collection of living specimens in terms of, small pots or botanical?
Yeah, no, dry specimens, always dry specimens. It's amazing what you can revive with a little bit of water off even a dry specimen. You can actually get the things to expand again, and you can do the work and then re-dry them.
Do they keep seeds as well?
The seeds are kept in two collections. One is the seeds that are associated with the herbarium specimens,
mm-hmm.
And often because they're bigger and don't press down quite so well, they're actually stored as a separate collection, and they're referenced from the sheets, so that if there are seeds associated with one, they're actually stored in there. But the other way of storing seeds, of course, is to be able to germinate them, but they have to be done in special conditions. That's something that hasn't really been done in New Zealand so far. That's gene bank.
Considering seeds in boxes, do you think the daisy will make it into the supposed Armageddon seed bank that they're building up in the Arctic soon?
Oh, most certainly. Yeah.
Because of the states, don't they have
underground? I think there's a, somewhere in the Arctic Circle. Is that right?
Yep, yeah. There'll be multiple collections throughout the world.
Yeah, I think there's I've come across it recently.
Yep.
Quite often this repository built in the Arctic Circle for pretty much any living.
The biggest problem is that not all flowering plants produce seeds. So the ones that don't, the ones that have chosen to go a different direction and reproduce only vegetatively, have got a problem with regard to that.
I found it really interesting to see when you mentioned about being able to revive something that's been dried with just a little bit of water, because it made me think of seeing your work at High Street and your tree, which actually, I'm not sure how many of you might have seen it, but a large section, pretty much a whole dead tree without the root wall, was placed inside the High Street Project space, and in a kind of fretwork of glass tubing stretched out and eventually along the room outside the window, and there was a funnel on the end.
That's right, I remember seeing that, yes.
But I was also interested, maybe seeing that if you consider daisies and or maybe nettles weeds, or maybe if there's something else about those plants that was of interest.
I guess I don't consider them both weeds, probably more than nettle.
Because I was interested.
Is that because it stings?
I suppose.
Or just because you're having to constantly take out your vegetable ground? It's interesting to think what plants have actually become problems in their own properties. My weeds in my place are sort of a combination of the generalised plants that are around that seem to be able to colonise places, and really stupid mistakes that I've made by bringing things in that I shouldn't have brought in, which have gone wild or made some dreadful mistakes, including one native one when I was living in Dunedin. I actually brought back some plants from the open zone with some soil. There was the seeds of a little crest plant that actually been just established on my property. So you never know what's going to become the next weed.
Mm-hmm. I like that it's so contextually motivated, someone deciding what a plant kind of is in terms of its
age. Yes, yeah. There are native nettles, of course.
Can't make it like that.
One of which we're trying to rescue around the city, a thing called climbing nettle. It's one of my work is once described as that it finds you before you find it. I remember the first time I ever saw it, I was out in Lake Ellesmere with Derek Rooney, who used to write for the press, and showing it. I was getting quite close to it, and he said, well, the funny thing about the climbing nettle is that it doesn't sting like the big tree nettle that you've got. I turned around and I said, I can assure you, Mr. Rooney, having just touched it, that it does. Okay, well, thank you very much. Enjoy the... How long is it going to be up there for? Because I think...
Till Sunday.
Till Sunday.
Thank you very much for coming, everybody. And thank you.
My pleasure.